It's not like a Mama Cass. Sorry, I apologize.
Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for December 9th, 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hello.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott from the Tribune and KUT News.
Good morning.
We are talking about budget posturing today, as well as freshmen and the budget decisions they have ahead. Also, the Democratic caucus, the weakened Democratic caucus, and what 2012 looks like for some of the folks whose races may already be decided. Let's start with Ben on the budget shortfall.
That's a good idea, because I'm on cold medicine, so let's get me out of the way as quickly as possible. Well, so last week we had State Representative Raymond put out a email saying he's going to file a constitutional proposition to declare all fees and other non-tax called revenue items taxes. And this is, of course, just in response to the Republican leadership's call that this is a no new taxes legislative session while they're cutting however many gazillion dollars from the state budget.
So Raymond's basically saying no gimmicks. If you want there to be no taxes, we're not going to allow you to get away with anything.
Yeah, that's always the hide the biscuit routine, right? We're not passing taxes. We're raising fees. You know, and fees are controlled by the users who pay the fees. They don't have to pay these.
Yes, it's a user fee.
Right.
Like, you know, you don't have to drive your car to work. You can choose to not pay your
driver's license
or your phone back when they tax or they
or if you're a barber your barber's license. I mean, you know, this is nuts. If the state requires you to pay money to do a thing that you were going to do otherwise, Raymond's saying that's a tax.
Well, and it comes on the heels of, you know, whispers around the Capitol that they're going to increase the fee when you register your car, maybe $10 or $15, and that money is going to go to help pay for
what is it
road
now
projects.
like 53 bucks 55
it,
bucks.
It's based on the car,
based on the car and the weight, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. I think mine was 78 bucks, something like that.
What are you like driving a Delta 88?
It's a Honda Civic. I wish I had a
like
Delta
Starsky?
88. Right?
What is it
well,
you're driving?
It's
actually
based on how new the car is and the size of it and all that. So, you know, an older piece of crap, you know, you wouldn't pay as much as a
well,
new
you really
SUV.
You really are on cold medicine, aren't you? This is like Philpott after dark. This is pretty good.
I was able to say crap before you in a podcast.
You get cold medicine every week, right?
What I recall either from your story or from reading it in his Facebook status at some point, or possibly both this week, was that Michael Quinn Sullivan, there's a name we say almost every podcast, duck comes down, he was quick to say, wait a minute, I actually don't support this Raymond plan. I think that fees are fees, and we shouldn't rename them taxes.
Some of them are and some of them aren't. You can't function in Texas as an adult, I mean, for the most part, without a car. So how is a driver's license thing a fee and not a tax? I mean, it's not like it's an optional, I'm only going to pay this fee, you know, voluntarily.
Well, it's not a tax because not everybody has to pay it.
Well, property tax is not everybody's have to pay.
Effectively,
right?
Everybody does.
If you have property, you have to pay a property tax, right?
Yeah, what I'm saying is effectively everybody does. You have to have a car to function in the state, you know, and they're going to make you pay this driver's license fee, which is not a tax, and they're going to make you pay these, you know, gasoline taxes, and they're going to make you buy insurance. And, you know, all of that stuff that government requires you to do, Raymond is trying to put into one pocket. So they say the government requirement that you pay this amount of money is going to be referred to as a tax. And if these guys are trying to balance the budget with these things, more to the point, you know, if these guys are going to try to balance the budget with these things under the guise of we're not raising taxes, Raymond's saying, look, voters want to know if you're raising the cost of government to voters.
This is the Wohlgemuth, I don't want more revenue argument, right?
Right.
So there are there's a side of this argument that says all new revenue is bad. And so an increase in fees would, in theory, be bad, too.
Now, Raymond says that he doesn't have a problem with an increase in fees. He just says, let's have that debate
well,
in full.
Well, Raymond, I don't suspect, would be
let's
on the side
what we
of
call
that.
It.
He just, you know, now, have you been able to determine if the car tag thing were increased? Can they get any significant money by increasing some
of
these
can.
Fees?
Sure they can. Sure
you
they
think
can.
So?
Yeah, there's
from,
a lot of money in those
from
things.
2003 until now. From the fees just raised or the new fees from 2003, the last estimate, according to the comptroller's office, was something like $3.6 billion was raised.
Just
in the fees.
But that was over many
over
years.
What?
Period.
The last,
it's a bunch
yeah.
of money. Right. There are taxes that are basically voluntary, too. I mean, so we call it a cigarette tax, right? We call it a tobacco tax. Most people don't smoke. Most people don't pay it. That's a fee, right? That's a
it's
user
It's not
fee.
A sin tax.
I mean,
it's a sin fee.
There's not a clear distinction made here. And all Raymond's doing is saying, if government's going to cost more and you're going to raise the price of government, don't hide. Just say I'm raising the price of government.
But isn't raising the car tag a regressive, as these things go, a regressive fee?
Well, considering—
Isn't that the average person who is lower in a lower socioeconomic group is going to have to pay the same increased fee as somebody who is—
The same increased fee, but they won't have the same base price, again, based on the value of your car. And the size of your car.
It's a value of your car thing? You're paying $78. What are you driving, a car made of gold? What is that?
It's a Honda Civic.
I just know, you know, in my family, two cars, the newer car costs more, even though the newer car is a little smaller than the older car. So, I mean, I'm not saying that it's a giant sliding scale.
To answer your question, yes, it's regressive. It's the same price applied to you no matter what your income is. So if you have lower income, it's a higher percentage.
So why not raise other fees? Why not raise the fee to get a hunting and fishing license? Why not raise the fee?
They certainly might do that.
They may well do that. They did that in 2003. That was the thing in 2003 was, we're not going to raise your taxes. Well, how come all this stuff got more expensive, right? I mean, and that's where this is going, is if you're raising your prices— Say you're raising your prices. Call them fees, taxes, call them Fred.
And this is really tantamount to the state deciding to shift costs from the state level to hospital districts and school districts at a local level. It's not really balancing the budget. It's sort of doing smoke and mirrors and gimmickry.
Right. They're not cutting. Right. Well, I think they are doing some cuts. In fact, they ordered some cuts this week.
But the point is, if they come out and they say we balance the entire budget or eliminate the entire shortfall through cuts— If they're increasing fees, then that's just a non-starter factually, right? No, you didn't.
Right.
Let's stay on the budget and talk a little bit about what the political implications are for the decisions coming up for the incoming members. Russ.
Well, I sort of mentioned freshmen just because they were having their orientation last week and got an opportunity to talk to a bunch of them. And, you know, they're in that moment of adjustment between we promised we would lower the cost of government. We promised we would cut government back. Generally speaking, yeah, it's too big. We should do something about that. Now they're up here, and over the next 5 or 6 months, they're going to turn those general statements into specific statements. We're going to cut that thing, and we're going to cut that thing, and we're going to cut that thing and that thing. And you have to reconcile these two things. And for freshmen, the only reason I mentioned freshmen in this context is because they haven't had to do this before. But you have to go home. You guys remember on the Jim Pitts tape where he's talking to the Tea Party in Ellis County and he says, we got to cut this stuff. We're going to cut Medicaid. And the guy says, whoa, wait a minute. Are you going to throw this friend of mine out in the street? Those are specific cuts. And this is the time the election's over and we've begun the conversation about these are the specific things that are going to get cut. And the freshmen, everybody else is going to have to do the same thing. But you have to reconcile your promises against what you need to do to get reelected. You're going to go back to these same people and you're going to say, either I did all of the cuts you wanted, and here they are. I hope this works for you. Or you're going to go home and say, I didn't make all the cuts because I would have had to cut this and this and this. They have to start making those calculations. This is politics. Now they're turning into politicians.
And these freshmen, you think, are only different in that respect from other people in that they've had no experience doing this before, walking that fine line.
This is the kind of thing that makes people define politicians as politicians. It's when you start making these choices, right, that you become political. It's a political choice. And you're going to have to go home and say, I didn't cut Medicaid because I didn't want to put those people out, or I knew I was putting those people out, but you guys wanted me to cut the budget. You have to find the place.
Or, for instance, Rand Paul gets elected in Kentucky to the U.S. Senate by saying, I'm opposed to earmarks.
Right.
And then literally before he's even sworn in, he says, oh, wait a minute, earmarks aren't so bad.
Right. You begin this process of compromise, and this is the stuff that gets politicians the reputation for being political. You know, this is exactly what they do.
Except the difference this coming session is that this class is more ideologically conservative than we've seen, right? It's a larger class, first of all, but a lot of these folks actually beat Republican incumbents in primaries. And so will they be more likely to stomach and defend these cuts, you know?
Right.
Like Rick Perry campaigned on the fact that they made some really difficult cuts in 2003 and stood by them. He said, this is an example of courage. You know, so
that's going to be the test. This isn't to say they should do this or they should do that. It's that they now have to decide. And you go home and you either are the guy who said, I will cut the budget and did, or you're the guy who said, I will cut the budget. And wait a minute, you killed that program that was so dear to us.
You remember I sent you something 2 days ago, the thing that Sarah Palin posted on her Facebook page,
right,
where she was basically saying, without naming any state, but she was saying, look, I want you to know that over here on Planet Palin, we object to the idea that states with shortfalls will rely on federal money to get through. Right. We think that that's lazy here on Planet Palin, and we think that you should just cut your budgets. And I sent this to Ross, and I said, yeah, I wonder what she thinks of Rick Perry. You know,
with $13 billion of federal money in the current budget,
who took all this money to balance, and then took money as well to balance the previous biennium's budget.
Right.
The reality is that these guys discover that, as we've said many times, campaigning is easy, governing is hard.
Right.
And at budget time, especially when you've got to make hard choices, that lack of experience does not remove from your responsibility having to make them. The fact right. that you've got no experience doing it, you still have to do it. You are now equivalent to the other 149 people in the House.
Right. Now you've finished campaigning. Now you have to start explaining yourself.
Well, I think it's going to set up interestingly. I know we'll talk about 2012 in a bit. It's going to set up interestingly for these guys as they go back home. The fact is that even if it's the smaller of the two projected shortfalls, these choices are not going to be easy. Morgan Smith has a story on our site this morning, as you all know, detailing just the education cuts that may be required. And they're everything from teacher salaries to teacher positions to removing the cap on class size.
Right.
You know, those are real cuts that affect actual people. And, you know, no one's going to be happy to discover that their kids were in a class that was capped at 22-1 and is now suddenly up to 30-1 or 32-1.
There's nothing more powerful than an alarmed PTA.
Let's stay on this topic of governing and a group that may not be able to have much power in those decisions, the House Democratic Caucus, which has gone from 74 members to 51. We're examining this week just sort of who's going to lead them, in what direction will they go, is there a play here when you are so severely weakened? And it sounds like they have a choice to make. They can either be like Washington, you know, be unified and therefore partisan.
Be specifically sort of, like the Republicans in the minority over
right.
the last
or
two
Democrats
years,
right. when yeah. they're in the minority, you right. know, turning the House's longstanding tradition of trying to work together and having lines that fall not along Republican Democratic on various issues, sort of turning that on its head.
Right.
Or do they try and engage still? You know, the members who are thoughtful and, you know, want to keep CHIP at 20% above poverty instead of just poverty. You know, try and get some small wins here or there because they did jump up in seniority. So it'll be interesting to see. And I feel like a lot of this depends on if a leader emerges. You know, with the absence of Jim Dunham, there is no strong leader anymore. It looks like it will be Jessica Farrar in the absence of anyone else.
Even though Villarreal's made noise about wanting to be
right, he essentially withdrew.
Caucus.
This week. Right. And so it's interesting to see what's going to happen, but it sounds like it's still not clear who's going to be the leader, even if Farrar is the
leader
in name.
There's a titular leader here. There's, you know, somebody gets the title, right? But who actually is the person that when they whistle, everybody comes? You know, the Democrats aren't necessarily unified on all this stuff. I mean, they're going to be places in this thing. We talk about the two Republican parties. There have been two Democratic parties for a long time. There are some people who are
more
conservative.
But most of the people in the conservative Democratic Party were defeated.
Well, that's not completely true. I mean, most of the ones who had Republican, you know, I mean, where's Aaron Pena on this scale? I mean, you know, they're...
Well, I wonder. I mean, I know he's listening, so I'm saying this to him. Aaron, are you going to switch parties?
Well, he's not going to switch.
Because that's a rumor.
Well, he says he's not
going
to switch
parties. He says he's not going to.
But the issue here, the reason that's even a question is because there's this, you know, tension inside the party. It's like, are we all running this way or are we all running that way? Well, on some issues, they may all run that direction.
Right.
There may be people that, you know, usually the parties and these caucuses and things, leaders emerge. Somebody will come out and say, we should all do this. And they kind of all go, yeah, okay, we'll do that. We'll all get on a bus to Ardmore or whatever it is. I don't know who that is yet. I don't
Wait
know
a
if
minute.
It's Jessica Farrar.
Robitussin over here has something he wants to say. Go ahead.
It'll be interesting to see what they do. We've already kind of gathered a little bit what the Democrats in Washington might do. There was a story in the New York Times this morning on the idea that's being floated of finding a primary opponent for Obama in 2012.
Russ Feingold.
To push him, as the article says, back to the left.
That worked for Jimmy Carter, didn't it? Didn't that Edward Kennedy thing?
Well, it did, but it I actually think it's better for Obama to be perceived as not to the left of, you know, to have somebody to his left running is actually probably from a branding standpoint probably pretty good for him going into 12.
Right. Well, this is what Clinton did after 94.
Look, I've contended for some time that the biggest problem for the Democrats right now is not the absence of a Karl Rove, but the absence of a Karen Hughes. I was saying to Elise the other day, I remember the days when Ann Richards was governor, as I know you do as well, Ross, very well, and when Karen Hughes was the spokesperson for the Republican Party of Texas,
right.
Having been a television reporter previously,
the grenade of the day club, right?
That person. And so it would not make a difference what happened during that day. There'd be a bank of microphones, and at the end of the day, Karen Hughes would be out in front of it, pissing all over whatever had happened at the Capitol. Democrats in the legislature, but particularly whatever Ann Richards did. If Ann Richards sneezed that day, Karen Hughes would be in front of the microphones at 4 o'clock declaring pollen communist. I mean, the fact is, she kicked every Democrat in the crotch that entire administration.
Right.
And she is as responsible for the signs of life in the Republican Party in the early 90s as anybody else. It's often attributed to Karl Rove or George Bush or Rick Perry. Karen Hughes really was that person. The Democrats have no Karen Hughes. The Democrats have no one person whose mission it is every day to go out there and kick the Republicans in the crotch, to make the intellectual and emotional case against the leadership. And in the absence of that one person, then they have got no leader. I mean, the problem with, I mean, I think you're right, Elise. It ends up being Jessica Farrar. Most people in the state, whatever party, but a lot of Democrats could not pick Jessica Farrar out of a police lineup. If you asked them who she was, they would not know.
Yeah, but at the time, they couldn't pick Karen Hughes out either.
But if you lead and no one follows, are you really leading? You know, I mean, right. That's sort of the problem for her.
I mean, she may be doing a perfectly good job. I just don't know. I don't know that any of us knows exactly what being the leader of the caucus is or means. Dunham, who drove people crazy to the point that they spent a bunch of money and beat him, was at least a very public presence.
Right.
Right?
You have to rise up to be the other party's lead paragraph in their fundraisers. You know, so Nancy Pelosi is in the lead paragraph of every Republican fundraiser, right? We've got to stop Nancy Pelosi and those people.
No Harry one's Reed campaigning and those people. Against right. Jessica Farrar.
Right. You know, if you're doing this job right, you become the foil for the other party. And somebody has to just step up and do that and say, you know, put on my asbestos suit and walk into the fire here.
Right. All right, let's look ahead. Let's jump ahead a few years to 2012. And how many years is that from now?
That would be two.
That's the election that started.
I'm not sure what day it is.
It's the election that started 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Well, it is.
That's it is. Yeah.
I really like Elise these ridiculous kind of sabermetrics that people use to assess the success or failure of parties and elections. And Charlie Cook has this formula that
Charlie Cook's very good at this.
He's very good, you know, you put in all this crap on the front end and then beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, and then at the other end comes, you know, this person's going to win or lose. And, you know, they're sometimes right and sometimes wrong, and it's hard to actually see waves. You know, one thing that many people will say is, well, 2 years ago, how smart was Charlie Cook about the outcome of this year? He didn't see at all that the Republican wave would come, and so this is all meaningless.
Is Charlie Cook because he called 1994.
Right, but he didn't call this because no one called this.
Right.
But even that accepted, he's now started to look at which races are likely to be competitive in 2012, the congressional races, understanding that redistricting is going to shake things up and you really can't account for
it. And that undermines the whole analysis for me.
Well, it does.
Right.
But let's just advertise that as a big asterisk on this. But his assessment with regard to the Texas congressional map is that the only two seats that are going to be competitive are the congressional seat in the Corpus Christi area that Big Solomon Ortiz had and lost by fewer than 1,000 votes to Blake Farenthold. I contend still that many people there thought they were voting for Sissy Farenthold, but, you know, we'll see. And then the Canseco-Rodriguez race in San Antonio, the Canseco won by quite a bit more than 1,000 votes. He believes that Cook believes that the Farenthold race is now going to be a toss-up and that the Canseco seat is a leans Republican, but that the CD-17 race, the one that Bill Flores beat Chet Edwards in, is not even on his radar screen as competitive. And I guess good news for the Democrats, none of the Democrat-held seats in Texas are on his list either. So that we may be looking at a situation in which just two people are up.
Well, win one for redistricting races. Then, right? I mean, these lines are drawn well enough that...
If you were running on the current districts, he's right. I mean, those are the two seats that are closest to the edge, you know.
But how likely is it that the change in the map are going to make any more seats competitive for the Democrats?
I think they are. I think they, you know, they almost always...
Explain.
They almost always do. You know, if you look at the Texas House, this is the easiest place to do this because there's 150 seats, and so you get more varieties, right? You get a lot more swing seats and all of that kind of stuff. You took about 15 seats that on the numbers, and when I say the numbers, I mean results of the last couple of statewide elections, that on the numbers were swing seats, and they were held by Democrats, and this time they went to Republicans. If you draw a map in the Texas House and say, in drawing your map, I want to make this map so that as many Republicans as possible have districts where statewide candidates who are Republicans win 55% or better, right? You draw about 85 seats.
You're not going to get to 99.
You're not going to get to 99. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you say, okay, so I can draw, let's pick an arbitrary number, 85 seats. And then I draw the next few seats. Well, how many can I draw so the Democrats don't have an easy win? Those are swing districts, right? You draw 10 or 12 of those, right? And then you just kind of depend on the year.
But what it's going to mean, though, is you have to pick and choose. You got to play God.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You got to decide, well, James White, sorry. Well, you're going to be in a tough race. We can't protect you.
Some of it's determined by geography. A lot of it's determined by the political clout of whoever's incumbent in the maps that are being drawn. But when you draw the congressional and the Senate maps, because you don't have 150 degrees of partisanship like you do in the House maps, you have 31 degrees in the Senate, you have either 35 or 36 degrees in the new congressional seats, it's harder to draw. It's easier to draw certain seats. That make sense? In the congressional delegation in Texas, in particular, the minority seats held by the Democrats can't be messed with much because of the Voting Rights Act.
Which leaves which seats that can be messed with.
Right. So there's one seat in particular that you can sort of tinker with. It used to be held, it was held last time they drew it by Bonilla. Now it's held by Canseco. It's a Republican seat, and they'll draw that thing as closely Republican as they can, while also trying to win with an Hispanic. It's, you know, sort of an interesting problem in Republican politics.
But I thought they were going to try to draw Doggett into a corner.
They've tried that before.
They keep trying to, but he has this foothold on the Colorado River. You know, I mean, it's the problem is that he's got Travis County, and Travis County, it's hard to draw him a map that Travis County doesn't overwhelm everything else. They're going to try to draw a number of Democrats out of seats, but they're, you know, it's easier to draw the congressional maps so that they're more or less clearly Republican or clearly Democrat. And the maps that were drawn in 2003 have held pretty well. They're pretty close to what DeLay drew in terms of partisanship. The Senate map in Texas has held incredibly well for 10 years. This many R's, this many D's. The only switch was Ken Armbrister, who was an incumbent Democrat in a Republican district. So, I think you're going to probably come out of this. Maybe it will be those two seats. Maybe it'll be something else. But you'll have one or two congressional seats that are in play and nothing else. You'll have one or two Senate seats that are in play and nothing else.
So much
no fun for us.
Well, it seems like their whole goal with Doggett and others was not necessarily to elect a Republican, but to elect a Hispanic Democrat and get rid of the white Democrat.
They were trying to knock off Doggett. They were trying to knock off six Democrats with Republicans. They got five of them. They didn't get Edwards. And then the Democrats that were particular thorns in their paws, Doggett, they tried to draw them out of a district so that at the least they could take away the seniority of the Democrats that they couldn't get rid of. If we can't get rid of a Democrat, let's get rid of a tenured Democrat and replace it with a new Democrat so that, you know, they're, you know,
right?
So Doggett doesn't have as high a position in the House, in the minority.
No one's going to take Doggett on, though, in the Democratic primary.
Depends on how they draw the district.
He had a Hispanic opponent for the primary when he had the district that went all the way down to McAllen,
right?
And actually backed by Senator Barrientos, right.
But
they lost.
I mean, not even wasn't close.
It depends on how they draw the district.
Yeah. Well, all right.
You can draw a district that he can be beat in.
All right. Let's close this out on behalf of Evan, Ross, Ben, Todd, the producer, and myself. Thanks for listening.